Well, how about a Big Mac?
Mom won't let me eat fast food. You know that. It's bad for you.
Well, come on. We can always sneak a Big Mac like we used to, you know? And a cherry turnover, your favorite. What do you say, Chili?
No.
Well, what do you want then?
Nothing.
Oh, come on. You can't have nothing. Now, we gotta have lunch. Mr. Pizzeria?
Same thing, Dad. Mom says that all that food's bad for you.
I don't care what Mom says. It's all right. I'm in charge today, okay?
Okay. So we'll get what you want. What do you want?
What do I want? Well, I don't know. I guess I can wait till we get home. Hey, maybe we'll stop at Wickham's.
Okay.
Fine. Okay. Oh, Chili, come on, honey. Oh, don't get sad on me, you know? I'm sorry.
What are you sorry for?
What am I sorry for? Well, I don't know. I guess it was the food business. I just thought, you know, we'd sneak a Big Mac on Mommy like we used to.
I want to go home.
You landed on The Substance, a podcast aimed at being biblical, thoughtful, and human. Join us here every other week as we engage the culture without the culture war. I'm your host, Philip Marinello, saying, hope you guys have had a good couple weeks here. Had a great time with Kate and Chess on last week. And this week we're back with another Substantive Cinema. And we're back with another Paul Schrader. Longtime listeners might remember that Paul Schrader's First Reformed was the very first Substantive Cinema we've done. I don't know how good of a show that was several years ago, but that was our first Substantive Cinema. So Paul Schrader's been a part of this ever since the beginning. And then not too long ago, we did Raging Bull, which was largely a Paul Schrader screenplay. And this week, we're covering Paul Schrader's Affliction. And this week, I was joined by Mitchell from Letterboxd, a regular host of the Letterboxd show, whether it's Four Favorites or Interviewing Creators or Weekend Watch List, just somebody whose work I have appreciated for a very long time. And pretty cool, as we talk about a little bit in the show, they've interviewed Paul Schrader. So some personal interaction and insight on both the creator and the specific movie that we're covering today. So very excited to share the show with you. If you're new, The Substance here, we are a Christian variety show podcast. We're a bi-weekly show where every other week we talk for about an hour, 60 to 90 minutes, sometimes on the really good conversations, they go a little bit long, about things related to faith, the arts, culture, politics. We talk to interesting and thoughtful people to try to think and live better. Previous guests include folks like Film Spotting's Josh Larson, Alyssa Wilkinson, Tyler Huckabee, Mike White from the Projection Booth podcast, Kevin McLenathan, and most recently Slim from Letterboxd as well. So back-to-back Letterboxd guests. This is pretty awesome here. So if you like movies, feel free to send us a line. I think in the show notes there we'll have a list of some of the prospective Substantive Cinema episodes we've got. If you've got a favorite that's not on there, feel free to send us an email, send me a DM, tell me, hey, like, you guys should consider covering this in the future, and we'll add that to the list. So without further ado, here's myself and Mitchell on Paul Schrader's Affliction. Mitchell, welcome to The Substance. It's good to have you here. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, and especially for a Paul Schrader movie. Always happy to talk Paul Schrader, and this is a very appropriate podcast, I think, to talk Paul Schrader on.
Absolutely, I appreciate that. And that's sometimes listeners or people in my circle who vaguely understand podcasting go like, how do you get some of the people you get on the show? And it's like, well, you ask people you like about something that they can add. Like, you give somebody an enticing conversation. You don't just go to somebody with a big platform and be like, come on our show. You've been the Schrader person. You've been one of Schrader's biggest fans that I've seen online and listen to hours of your podcast, read your interview with him. And I was like, well, here's somebody
who loves this guy. And I haven't even, this is a new one for me. So I've watched it twice in the last week or two, but this was a new one for me. I picked this. By the way, here, listeners, we're going to be talking about Paul Schrader's Affliction. And spoiler alert, I mean, this movie came out a long time ago. It doesn't exactly have twists and turns, but we're going to be getting it all. So if you want to watch it before, go ahead. I will say, I don't usually give any kind of viewer discretion warnings, but I went into this blind. This one's a downer.
It's tough.
Like,
it's
Paul tough. Schrader movies are not usually beams of sunshine, but I mean, I recently rewatched Taxi Driver late, and it did not bring me down as much as my first watch of Affliction when I was unprepared. So if you're gonna go into this blind before our conversation, be prepared for kind of a grueling experience.
Yeah, there's a filmmaker magazine interview that he did around the time that this came out about Affliction, and like some of the reviews kind of compared it to Taxi Driver or like Light Sleeper, some of his other stuff, and he like spoke about how he could kind of see the comparison, but one of the biggest differences is that a lot of those movies, even like American Gigolo, they like end on kind of these like grace notes, these like uplifting moments, whereas Affliction is just downer, like a bleak ending that just feels like kind of what is life even like worth.
There is, we talked about this on the Raging Bull episode, which Paul Schrader also wrote when I was talking with Abby. I think that there is, on my second watch, like the lightest glimmer potentially, and we can talk about that towards the end, but I was not prepared for the unrelenting just devastation of this film. But going back to the beginning, I picked this initially, having not seen it, knowing that you love Paul Schrader, wanted to cover a little bit more of his work on the show, and I don't know if it was his Marc Maron episode. Paul Schrader is very open. One of the things I love about him as an artist, he is not, I mean, he does think very highly of himself, and he's got, I'm not trying to diagnose him, he's got some very interesting thoughts about himself and his work, but he is not above, like, he makes art for the people, and he is very active. I think, I mean, we've done almost 30 of these shows, many of them with other guests. I think that most of our guests who are professionals in either critical spaces or things like that, I think nearly all of them have interviewed Paul Schrader, and he's on my list. I did an episode of a podcast with Mike White, who came out for a previous episode of ours, with a gal who actually recorded the Blue Collar commentary with Paul Schrader. So I feel like I got a good link to him potentially, if he would potentially talk to us down the future. So that could be cool.
Yeah.
I don't even really think the writer's strike affects him with how independent he is.
Yeah,
right?
That's the thing, is that I interviewed him probably like a week after the writer's strike started. And it was a whole thing where I was like, oh, like the writer's strike started, and I was like, oh, am I going to lose the chance to talk to Paul Schrader because the writer's strike just started? Like, is he going to pull out of doing press? Which if he had, you know, respect for that, like I wouldn't have, like I would have been bummed, but like understood it, obviously. But then so at the top of me and him talking, we were talking a little bit about the writer's strike, and he spoke about how like the issues that they're striking for, like he's in the WGA, but like the issues that are affecting these people don't really affect him because he writes on spec. He's like one of the few people who still writes on spec, and like this stuff is more affecting people who are like in writer's rooms and like that kind of stuff. Whereas he is kind of like a lone wolf. Like he's always been a lone wolf. He said that it was one of the first writers to really write on spec period. Like Taxi Driver was a spec script, and that was kind
of
the first. Yeah, right. Like that was just out there in the ether and like got picked up. And so he's always been one of these guys who's kind of in the system, but still a little bit outside of the system, and just really like does his own thing.
So thematically, before we get into the specifics, kind of setting the tone for this movie, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts, having watched nearly all of his films, having had the chance to interview him. So you mentioned Taxi Driver. He's talked very openly about the writing of Taxi Driver as being a bit of a self-therapeutic exercise to kind of exercise his own demons. Like the Travis Bickle character, he was him writing that was trying to purge himself of basically, like, that was like the dark mirror, like the worst version of himself that he could be. And I know that Affliction was based on a book, but I mean, any insights as far as like his upbringing? Did you guys get into that, the substance of the religious. I know you talked a little bit about his book on transcendental style.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get any insights out of that as far as like the impetus for him to be attracted to this material to begin with?
Yeah, when I spoke with him, we didn't get too much into the religious upbringing, but just from like reading, I mean, his book Schrader on Schrader gets into like a lot of this stuff, and like knowing his kind of the Calvinist upbringing and like how strict of a practice Calvinism is, like reading more about of affliction in general and why he connected so much with this is that like he said that his father wasn't abusive, like his father wasn't an alcoholic like the James Coburn character that we see in Affliction, but there was a like similarities in having a, I think he said, he described it as like a very strong father. I think his father was definitely like a men have their place, women have their place. And there was kind of this household of being like really afraid of, you know, disappointing your father or not becoming the man that your father thinks like a classic tradition of what a man is. And so I think that that's something that really resonated with him. I know that he said that just reading the first sentence of the Russell Banks novel that this was based on, like made him immediately drawn to it and want to make this as a feature. And so I think that there's definitely, even if it's not his original script, even if Affliction isn't specifically like distinctly religious in the way that some of his other films are, I think there's a lot here that he was drawn to based on his upbringing and being in such a strict household.
So I'll read the synopsis, which for me going into it, I was like, I knew it dealt with fathers and sons and generational issues and stuff like that. And then when I read this Letterboxd review, I was going and prepared for a very different movie. The synopsis reads, a small town policeman must investigate a suspicious hunting accident. The investigation and other events result in him slowly disintegrating mentally. And I was like, okay, it's going to be a little bit of a thriller. I was like, oh, Nolte, Coburn, Defoe, which Defoe's on the poster. doesn't show up until minute 55 of this two-hour movie.
The first voice you hear, though.
So I was like, what? I was getting prepared, more for a taxi driver-y like thriller. And there's only really like one or two scenes that kind of qualify that at all. It's more an internal drama rather than a thriller. And I was reading your review with him earlier today, kind of going back over to see if I had any insights that would go directly to this movie. And he talked about maybe not a pure bifurcation of, oh, in this time I kind of shifted, but he talks about how when he was younger, his sensibility as an artist used to be, you never want to leave the world without saying F you.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of shifted more to the love and redemption side. And this was clearly in the former camp of that. I was like, man, this is very, very much in that camp.
Yeah, I think like you said, it's a really tough movie to watch. It's the kind of movie where you are just looking for like the tiniest little ray of sunshine, like the tiniest little glimpse of a light at the end of the tunnel. And you're just like not getting it. And the Nolte character, like he is this alcoholic policeman. He is separated from his wife, like going through a really rough divorce. He's trying to like keep some sort of connection with his young daughter. And like everything just keeps cascading against him. His daughter clearly does not want to spend any time with him. He's like trying his best to find some way to like get connection with her. But it's the kind of thing where like his trauma is so ingrained in him. And this like this chip that he has on his shoulder is so built up that like he's lashing out at everybody and he almost can't help himself. And so it's tough to like, he's not necessarily a likable character, but I think one of the things that Schrader does so brilliantly throughout so much of his career is he takes these characters who could be perceived as like bad guys who on their surface, maybe you don't like them, you don't want to spend time with them, and yet you can still really empathize with them. And I think that he pushes through that kind of barrier to find a place of understanding where like the pain that this guy has is coming from. And yeah, in this one, you really feel that pain.
My goodness. So one person wrote in their Letterboxd review, I made a note of this, that at the time of the release, Schrader was quoted as saying, the character does such unpleasant things that you need an actor with an audience-friendly persona like Nick Nolte.
Nick Nolte. Like,
okay.
Yeah.
An interesting choice.
It's a different time of Nick Nolte.
He's very empathetic. Like, you want this guy to win. So, like you talked about, the first voice you hear is Willem Dafoe, who plays Nick Nolte's younger brother. And it starts out something like, I'm going to tell you the story, basically, of the winter season where my big brother lost his mind and like became like a criminal on the run. And man, okay, that's kind of intense. And rewatching it, that first scene with Nolte and his daughter driving to the Halloween party, I was like, I can see why Paul Schrader considered this one of his top four films. So one of the reasons I picked this is because Schrader, I don't remember if it's in the Mark Maron episode or something, a more recent, because he was looking back at his whole career saying, I think I've made four perfect films. Or yeah, I think he said perfect. He said Taxi Driver, Mishima, First Reformed, and Affliction. And I was like, wow, that's high praise. Especially like in grouping those with the other ones, like I had kind of sort of heard of Affliction. And it was on my radar. I was, oh, like, that's a Paul Schrader on my watch list that I'll get to at some point. But he's like, that's one of the four things that I think, like, the end product is, like, the perfect work of art that I, the writer and director, like, had in my head. And, like, as execution, that's perfection. And he put that in, like, Taxi Driver, he didn't even direct. So he's saying, in my entire career, like, this is one of the four things I'm the proudest. I was like, okay, like, we got to cover that in the show. Let's get Mitchell. Let's see if they'll join us and come on to the show. So rewatching that first scene, it really lays out everything in just the little things. Like the first words that Nick Nolte says in the entire movie was, I'm sorry for the screw up. I couldn't help it. And that's like,
yeah,
that is the line that literally is the whole movie. Like he can't help doing the destructive things that he does because that was the tools he was given.
Yeah.
He wasn't given it from James Coburn, his father's perspective. He was giving him like tough love that previous generations were thought that that's what you need. And maybe at a certain time, like maybe in the Depression era, like things were hard and you needed to like have a tougher skin. Like it is understandable. It clearly isn't good for healthy human flourishing and emotionally healthy adults and the children that are raised and who come out of that. But that was a thought at the time. But because of the way he was raised, he can't help the things he does in a way. Like he is in those ruts. He has those patterns. Willem Dafoe even has a line towards the end, like he didn't even have another perspective. Like there was no alternate perspective that he could shift to even when things got bad. It's like, and that's something we can all relate to, right?
Yeah.
Like you're doing things that you are trying to not do. And the more you try not to do them, you're like, and you need to have something outside of you, hopefully, like graciously, if something from outside of you can add to you and edify you and help you grow as an individual to hopefully break some of those patterns and do more things. But he just didn't have it. And when his daughter says he's making excuses, I guess, for their being late and the situation they're in is they're in a rush to the party. And she says like, well, Dad, whose fault is it if it's not yours? Like the dual nature of he was raised poorly, but he also has his own agency and he's responsible for the devastation he has too. That's a complicated thing. What were your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, I think that you saying that he can't help himself is, I think that's really, really well put. That puts like right, the hammers in, you know, exactly what it is. That is so, so upsetting to watch it because you can see him trying and like scenes like that. The stuff with the daughter especially, I think is the best example of that because you can see him wanting to be a better father, him wanting to have like patience with her. And the tricky thing with being like a young daughter, she's like, I don't know, like 5, 6, maybe. And like really young, that kind of age where she doesn't have any kind of filter. She doesn't have any nuance to like how she's expressing herself. So like, if she doesn't want to be at this party, she's just going to say, I don't want to be at this party. And like, that's it. And that can be like such a blow to a father who feels like he's trying to like really go out of his way to bring her to this nice place, like do this really nice thing for her. He's putting a lot of effort into it. He thinks it's going to be a really good thing. Like it's where her old friends were. He wants her to like have fun with her old friends. He thinks it's going to be a great time. She gets there and immediately she wants to go home. She doesn't want to be there. And like, that's just such a punch to the gut for him. But he then is like, he's trying to be patient with her. He's like, okay, well, you don't want to be like, we'll call your mom or whatever. But like, things just keep kind of getting worse. It, like, she's like, oh, I already called her. And then it's like, what do you mean you already called her? Like, you didn't even give me a chance to like talk to you about it. And so like that frustration is building and building and building. And you can see, like, that's the first scene, right? So that's like our understanding of just who this guy is. And then as the film's going on, we start to see more of these flashbacks with the father, James Coburn, and kind of how growing up, that anger and the shortness of that temper was just so ingrained in him. And so you can see him struggling with trying to manage that, but it's just so deeply embedded in his psyche that at a certain point, he can't help but having it boil over. And I think that, as you said, that's something that I think people can relate to, this idea of not being able to help yourself and having these things in us that, like when I think about it, so Affliction for me, it hits a soft spot because my father was never like physically abusive, but he definitely was like very verbally abusive. And like, I lived in a household where like my dad was very like domineering. I was very intimidated by my dad. Like I was scared to do anything wrong because of like his anger and his short temper. And so like that kind of hair trigger was something that was ingrained in me as being just like normal. So when I first got into like my first relationship, as like my first like adult relationship as like 19, 20 year old or whatever, I was lashing out at my partner like all the time because I thought that that's just what relationships were like. Like I didn't think there was anything wrong with that. And that relationship ended up, you know, not lasting partly because of that. And it's something that was just how I understood what the world was and how I understood what being like a man was and whatever. And it's the kind of stuff that I've had to try as hard as I can to unlearn. And I think Nolte, his character, doesn't have the like the wherewithal, the education base around him. He's living in this wintry town where all these guys around him are also like men's men. So like he doesn't have anybody. Willem Dafoe's character kind of got the hell out of there. He's the one who escaped. He didn't stay to try and help teach him these things. So he hasn't been able to kind of push himself to unlearn these things that he learned as a kid. And yeah, it's a struggle to watch because you do feel for him.
Well, and one of the most devastating, once they got to the Halloween party and it was clear that she wasn't having a good time and they kind of go into a side room to talk about it, one of the most devastating lines in that conversation was when the daughter was trying to reassure him that everything was okay. Mm-hmm. She says like, "Dad, I love you. I really do. I just don't want to be here. Like, I want to leave. I want to go home." And like the dad, I love, like, because of the way that Nick Nolte's character was brought up, love was mixed with violence and anger and these unrealistic expectations. So that's how he learned love. So as he is trying to love his daughter, he's putting her through these things, albeit like somewhat outside of his control, but he's still doing it. Yeah. And in response, she's like, "No, Dad, like, I want you to know that, like, I love you." And like seeing a little kid like plead with her dad to like know that everything is okay, like, that was just heartbreaking.
Yeah, it's really tough.
My father, not at all abusive, but not a well man. And when he grew up, mental health was very undeveloped and pretty barbaric. So he had a lot of things that I do have a lot of empathy for, but the person it made him in relation to me and my sister and my mom, it was not pretty. But there was so much love too. Seeing the thing that I see in myself that I want that I want to stop. And I don't want to be in my family with my wife and my children and just who I don't want to be, like, personally as an individual, like seeing those things in myself and fighting against them, sometimes feeling like when you get isolated and you're away from good people and good, helpful input, when you're just isolated by yourself, it can feel like, oh, like I'm just stuck. Yeah. And I'm stuck and I'm condemned to like repeat patterns. And if we are isolated and stuck, that is more likely. One of the things that Nick Nolte's character right at the beginning struck me again on the rewatch was seeing how same everything is. In small towns, no disrespect to small towns, part of that, that's part of why people like them, right? Mm-hmm. Is that they are dependable, they are safe, you get into your habits, your patterns, you know everybody. Like one of the characters even talked, "Oh, what's great is that we know everybody here." Mm-hmm. And when characters have conversations with each other, like, "Hey, how's it going?" "Oh, same old, you know," like there literally is nothing new. happening in these places. And when you don't have anything new, you have Nick Nolte. On the other hand, you have Willem Dafoe's character, who, like you said, he saw very clearly what he didn't want for himself. And because he didn't have the tools to change, he left in order to get them. And he's a very different person.
Yeah. Yeah. He talks like at later. So you mentioned that he comes in like 55 minutes in, he comes back into town. So we see a little bit more of him, and he talks about like he kind of retreated into like arts and creativity as sort of his escape. And so he was the one who was able to a degree, escape the brunt of his father's wrath. And Nolte was the one who took it all in and, you know, started to kind of imitate him in many ways. And I think that that's part of, like, likewise, like I've always really romanticized small towns. Like, I've always imagined it being this really wonderful thing to live in a town where everybody knows everybody. You know, you can walk everywhere. You walk down to the diner to get your breakfast every morning, and like they know what your order is and that kind of vibe. But we see here with Nolte's character, like, how much of a burden that kind of environment can be when the town that you've been raised in has held so much volatility and so much pain for you, because then everybody knows your pain. Like, so one of the earliest scenes in the movie is he's at the bar and he overhears a couple of other dudes, one guy talking to two other men about this, like, almost like mythic, like this like folk story that everybody in the town just knows and tells about this time that Nolte and Dafoe's father abused them. And like the idea of it just being a story that's spread around
town. Like a funny bar story. Yeah. Like, oh, and this one real bad winter, like,
yeah,
he put, like, they were like 10 years old and he made them go out and chop wood, but he was so drunk he didn't realize that the wood was like frozen together. And like,
yeah,
they made him work out there all day. And then he sees him, he goes, oh yeah, hey, how did that go? Like, how was that? Like,
yeah,
completely oblivious to the pain, and they were just laughing at it. Yeah. Like,
how do you recover from that kind of trauma when you're literally reminded of it every single day?
Yeah, no, it's difficult to impossible.
Yeah.
One of the things that I was also thinking, kind of broad picture, you mentioned that he's a policeman. It was a little unclear the first time, maybe slightly more clear the second time. Like, and that's not very important, like what the whole deal was. Basically, there's a patron, like the guy who's the head of the town, the richest guy in town, likes Nick Nolte.
Mm-hmm.
And Nick Nolte's kind of his guy, his go-to guy. And there was a scene where he talked about getting, he's like, what, you don't want the extra police pay? Like, but he's basically his buddy and he's helping him out because he clearly needs, he does provide services. Like, he's able-bodied, he's been there forever. Like, he can sort of perform the duties of a traditional small town cop, but it's not because he's qualified. It's because he's buddy with the guy in charge of the town. And thinking of Schrader's kind of whole MO throughout his whole career is you have a man with a profession.
Mm.
And he's talked about it often as that profession being a bit of a mask to kind of hide the interior. And I thought it was interesting dwelling on a little bit more here with, so Nolte's profession is cop, but even that is a little bit of a sham. So like, this guy is just such a harmed, broken guy that, like, not even like, you have taxi driver, first reform, card counter, master gardener, all these things. It's very clear, even these broken, hurt men have something clear that they do. But Nolte, like, if he really thought about it for a second, it's not like he's a great police officer who's doing a great job at this town. Like, he's got a buddy who's helping him. So like, even like the foundation that those other Schrader characters have, like, Nolte kind of doesn't even have that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really well said. It's, and he's so good at capturing what this guy's going. Like, he just does, he feels like such a sad sack of a, like, he just looks like a husk of a man. And Nolte is like such an intimidating, like, physical figure. Like, he's a big dude, and he somehow is able to contort his body language in this movie to make himself look so small, even compared to men. Like, so Jim Trufrost plays his, like, coworker, like another cop, who kind of the big, like, narrative, the catalyst for the narrative is that Jim Trufrost takes this wealthy dude on like a hunting trip. He's like supposed to show him hunting. So this guy, this wealthy man that Jim Trufrost takes with him, dies basically. And it's unclear to us whether it's like a hunting accident or if there was some foul play there. This is a big money bags man. There's some other, you know, potentially shady dealings going on in the town. And so, yeah, for me too, when I first heard of this movie, when I first saw it, I was expecting like, this is going to be Fargo, you know, this is going to be like, yeah.
Came out the same year as The Simple Plan too. And I always hear people talking about those things together. And it's like moral dilemma, icy thing. Like, this is, I mean, it would make a good double or triple feature, but they are.
Yeah.
This one is the anomaly.
Yeah. It's presented as like a neo-noir, like in the snow. And I'm all about that. Like, I love that kind of a movie. So I was definitely down for it, but it is 100% like a character study, like a descent into madness of figuring out what's going on with this guy. And I think that what it does so well is that idea that you said about the profession as a mask, like him, he just locks into, there's not really even much like evidence when he starts like theorizing that there was like foul play. As a viewer, it's like, you want to give into that because that's exciting as a narrative for a movie. Like, but if it wasn't a movie, you would hear this guy theorizing this stuff and be like, what are you talking about? Like, that doesn't even really make sense. Like, the leaps that you're making don't really make sense. But he like wants it to be true because he wants to be the hero. Like,
he wants to save the town. And it's like,
exactly.
And even that thought, like, save the town, this guy was an outsider who seemed to want to kind of, the idea is like he wanted to come and develop it and basically kick everybody out anyway. Like, solving the murder of that guy, even if it was a murder and foul play, like that's not exactly savior of the town type stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It just feels like he is so clinging to this idea of like needing a win because he's getting everything stripped away from him. His wife is gone. His kid hates him, like, or like doesn't want to be around him. Like, even if she, you know, she says she loves him, but she doesn't, like, immediately the second they're together, she's unhappy and doesn't want to be with him. Like, his brother's gone. His father has been horrible to him his entire life. Like, everybody in the town kind of sees him as just this sad sack. Like, he needs a win. And like, as a cop, this is what he's like grasping onto. And so it's like, it's this kind of thing where this one thing he thinks can save himself by saving the town. By saving the town, he can save his marriage. He can show what a man he is. And in that way, that does feel pretty similar to Travis Bickle and like the assassination plot of Taxi Driver, and him like focusing so intently on this one goal, this one action that he can do that is somehow going to like reform the country, you know, reform masculinity.
I want to mention the Trufost character of Jack. He also was, and maybe that's a commentary on small towns, but it definitely struck me as thematic. Like, he was also a bit of a character. Part of his backstory is that he was a baseball phenom and then had some sort of injury that like held him back. And then he got stuck and he never got out of his small town. Like, he also was somebody who is basically resigned to disappointment. Like, he is living with less than what he feels like he should be and has a chip on his shoulder because of it. I was also thinking of the toothache, which the more I thought about it like that, thinking that it's based on a book, I go, okay, that's a very novelistic flourish. Like, I spent a lot of time on my first viewing. Okay, toothache. Like, this is clearly like a device. Like, what is being conveyed? Like, what is this for? And you don't want to spend too much time going, okay, one to one. Like, what does this equal? Mm-hmm. But I noticed, gnarly scene. I was not prepared for when he took that tooth out. Like,
yeah.
Because this movie is not, and I think purposefully, no disrespect, I love Paul Schrader as a creator. I do think he absolutely excels as a writer and can sometimes excel as a director. Mm-hmm. I've never made a movie, not putting him down, but I don't think of him as, man, he's a great director. He's one of my favorite movie makers, but like, as a director, he doesn't usually have flourishes that I think of. Oh, like, I think of a Paul, when I think of distinctives, I think of story beats, I think of themes, I think of the substance. Like, that's what I think of when I think of Schrader. But that scene when he pulled his tooth was just, it was just so visceral and gnarly. Yeah. And having everything being relatively subtle leading up to that, that very much felt like the point of the toothache being something that was caused kind of by neglect and decay and him just kind of living with it and living with it. And then when he finally got pushed to confront it, he took it out. Like, then maybe there was like 20, 25 minutes left. Like, all hell broke loose.
Yeah.
Kind of from there. And I did watch an interview earlier today with Schrader talking about that the toothache was a bit like of an excuse to mask his pain. Like, when he would lose his temper. And then I noticed that, yeah, like with Sissy Spacek, with his daughter, with his coworkers, it's like, ah, yeah, sorry. Like, my toothache is acting up. Like, that was his, he could blame his bad temper on it. He could blame his bad mood on it. But then when he took it out, he's just living with himself. But it was also like, toothaches are caused by neglect and something that, like, a series of inactions that kind of led to that problem. And even Willem Dafoe is like, hey, you need to take care of the little things first. Like, the big things happen because the little things aren't in order. And in a way, it's wise words, but things had kind of piled up so much to when he did that, the dam broke loose and it was kind of, the dominoes fell after that.
Yeah, I wrote that line down too, that Dafoe line, take care of the little things first, the things that are getting in the way of you taking care of the big things. And like, there is, the tooth is one of them, like the most physical manifestation of that. There's also like a recurring thing of, for most of the movie, he's driving around his father's car because like the transmission in his car is busted. And so it's like in the shop and like, it's
yeah,
the
he's
kind
always
of thing
either driving,
like,
his dad's car or the rich guy's car. He's almost never driving his car.
Yeah. And so it's like these things, and that's also a neglect thing. Like, I mean, that could be like a financial thing, but we don't really see it as like a financial thing in the film explained that way. So it's also like a neglect thing. Like, this dude is just like putting on these blinders to the issues that are going on. And so he doesn't address them until it's too, like, it's past the breaking point. And like, there's a scene where he gets fired from like both of the gigs that he's doing, at like the cop job and then like the moonlighting kind of his other job. And like, after that, basically like every scene is just like things getting worse and worse, like dramatically worse and worse, and him just completely falling apart. And so it does feel through the movie like this thing is simmering and simmering and simmering, and then it finally hits the boiling point, and then it just like collides into the finale.
So before we get to that, we haven't talked much about Sissy Spacek, and she's like the heart of the movie. Again, small town, he's known her whole life, but recently, or more recently, Nick Nolte and Sissy Spacek's character have started a bit of a romance. And I also realized this is Paul Schrader's third movie and Sissy Spacek's third movie on the podcast. So I wonder, did Sissy Spacek and Paul Schrader work together much?
No, I think this was the only one.
Okay. But yeah, he knew that she was somebody who would work for a Paul Schrader budget at the time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And still, man, I don't know why these great artists don't get it. It's kind of heartbreaking. Like, as I say, zoom out, like, industry-wise, as a cultural artifact,
yeah,
most of Paul Schrader's movies are still out. They're making boutique Blu-rays of them because they're great. And it's like, guys, pay it forward a little bit. You have your $100 million making movies. Give some to like a true artist.
Yeah. One of the interesting things about Nolte being in this is that like, this is a movie that Schrader had been trying to get financed for like 5 years before it finally got made. And he originally proposed it to Nolte and wanted to cast Nolte earlier in the 90s. So like, coming off of Prince of Tides and like Cape Fear, and Nolte being the people's sexiest man alive, where like his
hilarious
his budget cap was like really high. And so when Schrader was first pushing this around, he couldn't even afford Nolte. And then when they finally were getting it made, Nolte's quote came down, so he was able to get him in there. And yeah, it is, it's interesting how people like that can be in a Paul Schrader movie. The thing too is like, Affliction, like, Schrader's movies are getting like this resurgence. And the thing with, you know, you being surprised about him mentioning it as like one of his four like perfect movies and one of his favorite of his own movies, like Blue Collar can get like a Kino Blu-ray, and like Mishima is on Criterion and stuff like that. Affliction's still only on DVD, which is like nuts. Like, somebody's
I'm waiting for imprint or Criterion.
I'm begging for it. But yeah, to go back to SpaceX, I think that a thing that I find very potent about this movie compared to some of his other ones is the position of women in the film, where like, so when I was talking to Schrader, when I interviewed him, I asked him about kind of the significance of women in his films, because he has a perception as a very macho director. Most of his movies are centered on men, but the women always play really important parts. And he told me, so he was coming off of the night before I interviewed him, he did like a Q&A at maybe like the Arclight or like American Cinematheque or like some of like one of the LA theaters. And he said that somebody in the Q&A portion of that event asked him, or like accused him of using women as symbols of redemption in his films. And that his response was that the women in his films are not symbols of redemption. They are in fact redemption. And he even quoted to me the line in Affliction, that Defoe says at the end, those poor, sad women who have the misfortune to love us. And I think that speaks really strongly to what's going on in Affliction and how Affliction takes that bleaker turn than a lot of his other movies do. Where, so if you look at Master Gardener, you look at First Reformed, you look at The Card Counter, these are movies of guys who are really lost, like struggling with not only their place in the world, but the world in general and how the world is kind of falling apart. And
how to live with what they've done in the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that grounds them, connects them, makes them want to keep going is a woman comes into their life and gives them this connection. And so Affliction is like, it teases that same kind of path with Spacek, because she is really the only thing that Nolte has going for him. Like she genuinely cares for this guy. It's looking like they're going towards a marriage, but his... this descent into chaos for him is so severe that he ends up pushing her away. And it's like the moment where he loses her is the moment where there's kind of no turning back. Like he doesn't have the one thing that he could have had anymore. The one thing that was kind of holding him like a little bit from tipping over the edge. And then so like her part in it is so important, and she's, I mean, her performance is tremendous. That's saying Sissy Spacek, you know, gave a great performance, is, you know, I mean, of course, but she just is so great at the understated kind of capturing of what this woman's going through.
No, and when I took note of that line too, and I'm glad you told the story, that's a lot better than me teeing you up with it. That was, I thought that was very insightful. It helped me kind of look at Sissy Spacek's role in this, because, yeah, when you're on film Twitter or film X or whatever you are, whatever it is now, and hopefully it'll, whatever the new social media platforms are, we'll get something that is hopefully healthier, but be able to have that discourse. Mm-hmm. I can kind of roll my eyes, like artists have just vibes that they're on. And when you see patterns, it's easy to like see the pattern and then attack that pattern. And I've always appreciated Paul Schrader for, even for when he is crude and crass and maybe not like when you look at it and you go, ooh, yikes, like some of the stuff he says or does, or even some of the art he makes, he is being honest. And I feel like there's value in that. And he knows that sometimes he's been pretty jacked up. So when I see the stories and the women in the stories, you see the people on film Twitter going, oh, like women are just plot devices. And I go, I don't really see that. Like, I understand the criticism, and I get, like, I love full-fledged, like, people of all sorts need representation. But I don't think that that's exactly what Paul Schrader's going for. He is saying that the men, a lot of them being reflections of himself, is he needs that relationship that you talked about. Like being isolated and alone does lead to a lot of destructive things, and that the women are not just symbols, like they are agents of redemption. And in this movie, over and over, Sissy Spacek, to various degrees of success, eventually at the end, taking his daughter away from him to actual physical safety.
Yeah.
But she is an actual agent of redemption. I don't feel like she was a mere symbol, both in giving him comfort and solace, and for her trying to help him connect with his family and trying to help James Coburn as an even older, grumpier, crummy guy, trying to better himself and calling him to account for the way he treated his wife and not taking, like, she's one of the few characters who wasn't intimidated by James Coburn saying, like, I know you. Yeah. Like, my mom comforted your wife basically after the way you treated her, and just like how bold she was. Like, I didn't, I absolutely did not find her to be a token of any sort.
Yeah, there's a line. So the Coburn's wife dies in the film, and this, I mean,
how brutal,
brutally upsetting.
And that was it was done. I'll let you set this up, but on the rewatch, it kind of mirrored the scene. I don't know if it was exactly when they came in from the snow shoveling episode. Nick Nolte went upstairs to find his mom to like find comfort. Mm-hmm. And then that's kind of mirrored in the scene with Sissy Spacek.
And she, yeah, yeah, exactly. And then she's gone, you know, and it's like at the funeral, Nolte's ex-wife says this line, says, "You never know how much women like that suffer. It's like they live their whole lives with the sound turned off and then they're gone." And I mean, that line like hit me like a ton of bricks. One, like it's something that I could very much see like in my own like mother growing up, and like just the contentious relationship between my parents. And then also like, I think it resonates so strongly throughout what we're seeing in this film, and that these struggles with masculinity and this rage that these men have, like it is not just impacting them and being passed through generations. Probably the biggest impact that it's having is on the women around them, these women who suffer in silence, and like the damage that it wreaks on them. And that's the stuff, like that, the mom just dying silently upstairs, and not like, who knows how long she was even dead up there. Like, we don't even really know. Like, and like that is just the most heartbreaking thing in the movie. Like, that hits like a ton of bricks every single time I watch it.
Yeah. I didn't notice it the first time, noticed it the second time, right before Nick Nolte pulls his tooth and things really go down. James Coburn and Sissy Spacek are talking, and one of the affectations that both James Coburn and Nick Nolte have is this thing where they pour some salt on their hand.
Yeah,
and
they lick the salt. Yeah.
And she, I think she doesn't like that Nick Nolte does it, because they're friends, lovers, like may get married down the road. And then she sees his dad do it, and just that look on her face of recognition, and just like she fast forwarded like 30 years in her head, and is like, this is Nick Nolte in 30 years, and I don't want to be with this man. And you could see that decision was made on the spot, heartbreaking. And then Nick Nolte doesn't even realize it. He pulls his tooth. He's like, "Oh, my, like things are going good now." Like, yeah. And she leaves, and he's completely oblivious to the whole thing. And then the end of that scene was, I didn't have the most ideal viewing experience because it was pretty intense. And I have a little bit of a small house right now. I did watch this on my phone with really good earbuds.
Yeah.
But the cap to that scene was Nick Nolte with a bottle of booze in his hand, sitting down in the chair next to his dad.
Yeah.
And they're drinking together. And that's a moment of like bonding. Like that's their, like, that's the sweetest, nicest bit together of them both kind of, treating Sissy Spacek poorly, not realizing it, and sitting down together to drink in like hostile silence. Like that's their most tender moment. That's just like that almost made me cry just thinking about that. Like,
yeah. It's I mean, it's like a moment like for the audience where we have that kind of recognition of, you know, this guy is his father's son. And I think that being able to see kind of the flashbacks with Coburn, with, you know, Nolte and Defoe as kids and Coburn abusing them, like it's shot through this like grainy kind of like 16mm looking like footage. And he's so good. Coburn is so good in those scenes. He's so good as like a drunk. Like, I've been around a lot of drunks in my life, and he has this kind of like this slurringness to him, this like almost like dead behind the eyes kind of look that I think is really tough to capture as an actor, because actors tend to like overplay being drunk. And he has this like vacancy in his eyes where like, you know, you could sense that like if you talk to this person, you like, you're not even in the same world as this guy anymore. And like, that's a really unsettling feeling. And I think he captures that so well. But just as well, the present day scenes, he has this kind of like resignation to him where he's such a, like a smaller man in his twilight years. And you can sense that like he kind of to a degree knows that he's been like a piece of crap his entire life and like done nothing but harm the people who relied on him, and now he has like nothing left and he's just kind of like sulking through life, and there's something really pathetic about that. And I think that he captures that really well, but then you still get moments where that hate and that rage springs back up. There's a scene like after, so the other sibling that Nolte and Defoe have, they have a sister who is barely seen, barely heard, as are, you know, the women in this world. And where they are, where she does come back is right after the mom dies.
Yeah, for the funeral.
For the funeral. And she tries to initiate this prayer. So the sister has become like ultra religious. That's kind of like her.
Yeah, she's like witnessing to everybody at the funeral.
Like her escape to get out of here was to dive into religion and like use that as kind of like her saving grace from, you know, this horrible upbringing.
Well, yeah, that's her coping mechanism.
Exactly.
Like,
yeah.
Defoe's was education and refinement.
Yeah.
Hers was overeating and Jesus, and Nick Nolte's is following in his father's footsteps.
Yeah, exactly. And so the sister like tries to initiate everybody in a prayer, and everybody, even Nolte and Defoe, like they don't buy it, but they go along with it to be respectful. But then it's Coburn who just starts lashing out, and the way that he like mocks and belittles everybody when he's lashing out is so chilling. And it's such a great moment, like from a storytelling and from an acting perspective, of like, you still see that old lion in there. Like, this guy is not, he's not any less of a bastard than he always was. It's such like a great performance measured throughout these different phases of his life that we see.
And a moment like that really caused me to like reflect on just the tragic, I don't even know exactly what the right word is, because it's, what did he expect?
Mm-hmm.
The whole tough love thing. Did he expect his kids were gonna like love him?
Mm-hmm.
And like turn out to be well-adjusted people? It's like, yeah, they found different coping mechanisms because they weren't safe. And it sadly seems like the only kid he respects a little bit is Nick Nolte, when Nick Nolte violently resists him, like, and he pins him against the wall and threatens to kill him. Like, you see a little bit of, oh, like, that's my boy.
Yeah.
Like, you're finally a man. And it's
exactly
like, how just deeply, deeply tragic that is.
Yeah. Cause that's what he thinks that, you know, men should grow up to be.
That was his goal.
Exactly.
That was how he was trying to raise his sons.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's impressive casting too, because I know Schrader, like for Schrader, he had a difficult task of, once he cast Nolte, needing to cast somebody who could look like they would intimidate Nick Nolte. And
that's
like,
true. That's very true.
They were originally like, he pitched it to like Paul Newman at first, which like Newman's one of our greatest actors, but I don't think, I mean, maybe he could have
physically
pulled it off, but
imposing,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. But like Coburn, you buy it. Like, you buy that even Nolte is bigger than him, but you still buy that like he has been made to feel so much smaller than this man.
One of the scenes that you mentioned in the flashback and in the grainy, Coburn hauls off and hits him hard. Mm-hmm. And he was probably 10 or so at the time. And you can just see the ripple effect of that to the present, that when James Coburn pops off his chest and leans into him, mm-hmm. that Nolte, being younger, bigger, stronger, as like a 40-year-old or whatever he is in the movie, his first instinct, which again goes to his acting abilities, is to shrink back, and you buy it.
Yeah.
Because Nick Nolte, at the time, he was at the height of everything.
Yeah.
But you buy that he is being kowtowed by this imposing figure who has, throughout his whole life, just kind of dominate.
Yeah, and then it parallels then too, like the moment where Nolte starts to kind of see like just how severe all this was is that moment that you talked about where Spacek is leaving him, and he's bringing his daughter back to the house, and she's trying to get him away, and he doesn't it like intentionally do it. It's like an accident, but he hits his daughter, and like it's like that same moment, like he is now seeing that mirror of himself. He's seeing SpaceX taking her away, and he's seeing that like he at least feels like there's no real turning back for him. He's just become this monster that traumatized him as a kid, and like that's a really a tough moment to see, I think.
And that's the finale. I mean, not to just walk step by step through it, but I thought that was Yeah, he just lays there on the ground.
Yeah.
Just accepting his defeat. And until his dad comes and kind of gives him a hard time.
Yeah.
Like, he is at the lowest he's ever been. And his dad, who at this point can't really do a whole lot to him.
Yeah.
He's just there still belittling him, who has lost it all. And the way it ends, just with Coburn in the shed trying to attack Nick Nolte. And Nick Nolte not even trying to, like, do much other than just kind of get his dad off him. Ends up.
Yeah.
Killing him and in the shed, just burning him alive. Or do you think he was dead? Was it the idea that he was definitely dead at that point? I mean,
yeah, it's tough. I think it's ambiguous for sure. It definitely.
I don't think he was trying to burn him alive exactly. I think he accidentally killed his father in the scuffle there, and it's like trying to purge it, like the thematic, exactly. Like it's very big, and again. After having everything being so of a certain type, setting his dad on fire and then having a drink while the shed, the barn burns in the background that was cinematic.
And I think one of the genius, like, formal moves there too is that in that moment, it then switches to that, like, 16mm grainy, like, home video footage of what we're seeing in the present day, which is like the kind of repair, like, construction men and everything, like, picking up the wreckage of the burned down barn. And so it's like now, like, it kind of brings us full circle to seeing how everything that we've just seen in the present day is now this, like, relic of a traumatized past that Nolte has now brought on. And I think that one of the interesting things, I think the first time that I saw the movie, I was a little bit confused by how it's framed as Defoe's character telling this story to the audience. Like, I didn't quite get that, but watching it, you know, a few more times over the years, I think that it adds this really, like, elegiac, somber tone to it, where instead of having the story told through the eyes of Nolte, we see it as Defoe's character, like, looking back with this, like, eerie sense of remorse for the fact that he couldn't stop what was coming. And, like, there's this, like, guilt hanging over the movie that we get from Defoe's character, which is really interesting because he's only physically in the movie for, like, 10 or 15 minutes. But you can still kind of feel his presence looming over it. And I think that that adds, like, a really, like, somber, like, almost like inevitable kind of feeling to where the story is going.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, he calls the shot, like, literally as the credits are done rolling. He goes, this is the story I'm going to tell you. And I wondered about that framing device as well. And I wonder if, and again, I don't know, do you know, is the book framed that way, or is that more?
I haven't read the book. I would assume so, right? Because Schrader's also, like, said that the movie is very much like a collaboration between him and Russell Banks, the writer of the original novel. So I feel like I'd need to read it, but I feel like it's probably a pretty faithful adaptation.
And I wonder if it was something along the lines of maybe talking about just the value of bearing witness and telling the story to, similarly to Paul Schrader's goals of some of his other clearly, like, fictional work where he's trying to exorcise his own demons. Maybe, like, hey, for the reader, for the audience, like, beware. Like, this is the way, this is the end of these things. So almost maybe a bit of a cautionary tale in a way to look out for yourself, look out for the people in your life, perhaps who are going down these. And not that it's, again, it's not preachy at all.
No.
It's not any of those things, but just, I think that it, and it also has something to say, just the value in humanity.
Yeah.
And his life isn't less value because he likely ended up a vagrant on the
road. Yeah.
His life is not less valuable. So remembering and just bearing witness to his life, that has value just kind of humanistically and, like, spiritually, like, cosmically in general. The lives of all folks, like, everybody's life has value, and his life doesn't have less value because he was broken and it ended tragically. And there's something very beautiful about that, even in the tragedy.
Yeah, I think Schrader, for so much of his career, is a guy who has gone back to the well of this, like, these idea of broken men who have done horrible things and are seeking redemption. And I think he often has the audience ask, who deserves redemption? Is there anybody who does not deserve redemption? And I just love that idea of confront. Like, I don't think any of us fully has, like, the answer to that. I certainly especially like these days in the worlds of like cancel culture and like all that kind of stuff, like what does reformation mean?
Sure.
Is a really interesting question to ask. I certainly have had moments where I felt like people are, you know, beyond redemption, or even if they were seeking it, don't deserve it or whatever. But is that like a fault of mine that I would feel that way about anybody? And I think that one of the interesting things about Schrader's films is that he makes you confront that, and he can really make you confront that sometimes. And I find it very effective.
Well, yeah, especially here. I mean, Raging Bull, you mentioned that as well. Like, that has such a special place in my heart for so many reasons. I see all the different uglinesses, very specifically, like the angry Italian upbringing is different than the drunken winter one. And I see myself very much like that could be a very bad path that I feel very grateful that through a number of reasons I've avoided. But yeah, that question of redemption, and that not everybody slows down, and especially in the world we live in with entertainment and stimuli everywhere, like that's not something that we are going to come across regularly. Like you said, I think it's great that people are being held accountable, and I think that consequences are good. And consequences can be redemptive, but it can be very easy to be reactionary and kind of have the unexamined thought of these people don't deserve it. I do appreciate the artistic, it's not even pushback, because it's not polemic, it's just the art speaks for itself to bring up these questions.
Yeah, well said.
Good, sad, intense movie.
Yeah.
That I was not. Yeah, this is not one I'm going to be watching on a loop.
Yeah, I hadn't seen this in like a decade, and I had it on. I have like a kind of secret letterbox list of like movies that I want to watch like soon, like shortly. And I've been wanting to rewatch this one, especially because of me doing the Schrader interview and everything. I've been wanting to just kind of revisit some ones that I hadn't seen in a while. And so you asking if I wanted to do this one was really great to like motivate me to finally, you know, take the plunge. But yeah, within like 20 minutes of watching it, I was like, oh, right, this is like a downer. This is definitely like a once every like 10 years kind of a yeah. watch.
Yeah, this is not a reacher.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I really appreciate the enthusiasm. Like, oh, like this must be like, you're like, yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely.
I was like, okay, great. Yeah. And I turned it on. I was like,
so hyped.
Oh, okay. This is what that is. Well, yeah, listeners, I hope that you were able to make it through the movie. And if not, I hope, yeah, able to bring up some of these things. I always appreciate Schrader, even when he's at his depraved and kind of unhinged. I feel like he is always leaning in. He probably can't get away from it because of the way he was raised and all the things that were imprinted on him. He can't help but lean into transcendent themes and questions, and even some of his most gnarly stuff I feel like has value.
Yeah.
So, Mitchell, one of the things we do here on The Substance, we only really have one segment, and that's Substance Shoutouts. And it doesn't have to be something terribly substantive. It can be like this with deep themes to chew on and stuff like that. But what have you been watching, reading, listening to? Has there been anything that you've particularly enjoyed or you want to recommend folks check out?
Yeah, So I think before we started recording, I mentioned that I'm kind of going through a lot of Ridley Scott's movies, like rewatches and first watches for this other podcast that I'm going to be appearing on. And one thing that I did check out for kind of the first time, so Kingdom of Heaven, the Ridley Scott movie from 2005, I had seen it in theaters. I liked it. I had always heard that it is like the director's cut is like substantially better than the theatrical cut. And I had never seen the director's cut. So just a few weeks ago, I finally watched there's a director's cut, and then there's a director's cut roadshow edition, which is basically my understanding the director's cut, but it just has like a prologue, like, and then like an intermission, like yep. different musical themes that are kind of cutting throughout. And I watched the roadshow version for the first time, and it really like I blew me away. I'd always liked the theatrical, but the roadshow is like a completely different movie. There's so much more substance to certain characters, like Ava Green's character, especially in that movie. And so for people who don't know, it's capturing a period of time within the Crusades, and it follows Orlando Bloom's character, who was like a blacksmith whose wife died, and he murders like his brother and kind of goes on the run and joins up with the Crusades and kind of gets involved in the Crusades in a more substantial way. And I was really impressed with how it tackled the idea of like this character is somebody who is kind of positioned as the noble, like, hero, like the cinematic hero, but we see throughout the movie how like it's not really his station in life. Like, this isn't the position that he's supposed to be in. It's not the position that he even really wants to be in. And he's kind of like understanding that like these petty squabbles, like all of the deaths based around, like all the deaths due to people believing that their religion like is superior and like demands them shedding blood for their religion, this sort of like warped, you know, the kind of warped understanding of religion that has happened over the existence of time, basically, where people use that as a means to wreak violence. I just found it very effective. I also found it very bold for Ridley Scott to make like such a big Hollywood movie in 2005, 4 years after 9/11, that is very much like positioning the unnecessary, like unjust harm that has been caused upon Muslims like over centuries. And like that, the fact that like the Muslims in Kingdom of Heaven are basically presented as like, they were right to push back, they were right to, you know, fight and everything. And like, I think that's a very bold move to make a movie like that in 2005, when so much of America was still in that kind of like immediate response to 9/11 of having this like really huge streak of Islamophobia. So yeah, Kingdom of Heaven, if you've seen it, if you've seen the theatrical version and didn't really like it, I would say check out the Roadshow version if you haven't. And if you haven't seen it at all, I would just start with the Roadshow version. It's really a masterpiece, I think.
But I got that on my shelf. I'm excited to check that one out. Anything else?
Yeah, looking at just kind of like my Letterboxd, I watched Mamma Mia for the first time in a while. Mamma Mia is very fun.
First time in a while.
Yeah, like... I had seen it before, but it was really... I really liked it. People like the second. I watched the second. So I watched the second one for the first time. People seem to like that one more, but I think the first one's a lot better. I think the music is very fun. It was exactly what I needed on like a Saturday, just kind of vibing.
Nice little palate cleanser.
Exactly. Exactly. Also, I mean, I'm sure most people listening to this have probably seen Oppenheimer by now. Oppenheimer rules.
That's another one. I've seen Barbie twice. I haven't seen Oppenheimer yet because the babysitter and the 3 hour and the car rides both ways. Like, that's just logistically challenging. Yeah.
I just saw Barbie for the first time yesterday, though. That was better than I was expecting it to be. I didn't have like huge expectations. I thought it was going to be like a fun time, but not much more than that. I really liked it. I was very emotionally affected by it and also found it extremely funny. I think Ryan Gosling like crushed that.
Yes. So good. Like, sneak comedy from a studio.
Yeah.
Anything because of your position at Letterboxd, is there maybe one or two things coming in the few months that you want people to maybe look forward to that you've either seen or you want to get some buzz going on about? Anything that's maybe not Barbie and Oppenheimer level big that you want to kind of shine some light on?
Say one kind of smaller thing is this movie Aporia, Aporia, is this like really tight little like lo-fi sci-fi movie starring Judy Greer.
Okay. And I love like, lo-fi sci-fi.
Yeah, exactly. And she's a woman going through a grieving process who kind of dives into maybe being able to travel in time. And I won't give too much more away. It is definitely like most lo-fi sci-fi. It is like one that you don't want to know too much about going in. But it's really exciting. If you like lo-fi sci-fi kind of stuff, like, it's really compelling. And it's also the main reason why I was excited about it is that it gave Judy Greer the chance to have a leading role. I think she's such a tremendous actress who often does not get the chance.
She's very good.
She's really great and doesn't usually get to be the lead in a movie. And she absolutely crushes it in this. So if people, I think it's coming out on VOD and maybe in like select theaters on August 11th. If people...
Listeners, you can get ahead of it. Thank you, Mitchell, here. That's only got 110 logs on Letterboxd so far. 110, period. So get it on the ground floor. It doesn't even have an average rating yet.
Yeah, yeah. It just premiered at like Fantasia Film Festival, which is how I saw it, with like a screener through there. But yeah, it'll be on VOD soon for people to watch.
That looks great. Well, thank you, Mitchell. I appreciate this. Thank you for those recommendations and shout outs. And where can folks find you in your work? I'll link to social media, Letterboxd. What do you want folks to take a look at?
Sure. Yeah. You can find me on Letterboxd, letterboxd.com/Mitchell. I write for Letterboxd most often, our editorial platform journal. I co-host our podcast, The Letterboxd Show. You can find that stuff. I mean, you can find me on X at...
I'm calling it Twitter. I'm not...
it's the first time I've ever said it. It didn't feel right. It is Mitchell on there, where I freelance at other sites like Paste and Film Stage and stuff like that. So, but anything that I am doing, I'll be promoting on my social media. So
when I had Slim on for The Gray, I kind of looked at my stats and going, oh, Slim is kind of responsible for some of my biggest stats with all the On Cinema specials that I've watched. Now that I've got you on the show, like, not just because you're here, it's funny, from Letterboxd employee to Letterboxd employee, I think you will be at the end of the year responsible for my responsible for my number one director. I would be shocked if anybody.
I'm happy to get people to not have the On Cinema guys as their.
I like that. I love that they have entertained me very much, but I was like, do I want to get this Natarna Cola at the top of my list? I will feel a little bit bad as a cinephile there. Yeah. But yeah, no, I've been enjoying it so much, and I've been trying to also figure out if I can either justify or get early birthday money to get that imprint Walter Hill set before it goes out of print.
Yeah, it's a really good one.
Thanks for this, and we'll see you later.
Thank you.
So that was Mitchell from Letterboxd talking Paul Schrader's Affliction. That was a heavy conversation, but that was a great time.
It was a great conversation, and I have not seen Affliction, and you guys simultaneously like made me want to watch it and also never want to watch it at the same
time.
Is it
kind of like it? Did you ever do that with Raging Bull? I feel like you said that with that one too.
No, I don't know if I said that. I've seen Raging Bull. Okay. It's been a while since I've seen it.
Okay.
Yeah. But I loved, you know, that Mitchell was able to get personal too. You know, you talked about the movie, but it's always great to get to like know your guests a little bit too through the conversation.
No, absolutely. And I mean, this is one that, I mean, even if one has a really good relationship with their parents, I feel like it makes you think about the job that you might do currently or in the future as a parent. But like, fraught family dramas, I feel like they always touch a nerve.
No, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's like being a child is something we can all relate to. And so even if you had a relatively good or an actually good upbringing, yeah, I think it definitely touches a nerve there and can make some things spring up that maybe you weren't even aware of.
So great movie, challenging movie. If you've listened to this whole episode and you haven't seen it and you're interested, I believe it is currently streaming for free on Tubi and Amazon's Freevee channel or service. So you might just be able to find it on Prime. I'm not 100%, but I know on the Amazon Freevee app or channel, you can check it out there as well. I believe those both have ads, but if you want to watch it for free, those are the two places that you can currently do that.
If you enjoyed that episode and episodes like that, you can support the Substance Pod. We've been talking about this for a while.
Hey, yeah, it's finally announcement week.
You can do it over at patreon.com/thesubstancepod.
So our Patreon is launched.
It's launched. It's live.
What are we now? 135 episodes? We finally switched over from the Spotify.
Well, yeah, 135 episodes is a while. I feel like since I've been here, we've been like, all right, we're going to do it. We're going to do it.
Hey, man, it takes time and effort.
Yes. Well, yeah, we want to do it right. So you can head over there. You can become a patron.
Link's going to be in the show notes. Make it real easy for you.
Yep, just one click away. And for as little as $3 a month, we have a couple different tiers up to $20. But right now, all patrons will receive all of the perks. And all of the perks are helping us determine some future episodes, but we've got some plans to roll out some more as we go forward.
Yeah, like Dave said, we don't want to keep anything from folks, and as we decide to roll out and actually put forth benefits to you guys, we want to do that in a thoughtful way, kind of in keeping with the brand. So right now,
all the tiers will have the same benefits, and we're excited to start to have listener determined episodes. We're talking right now whether those going to be main feed or bonus just for the supporters. But either way, if you join, like you said, as little as $3 a month, you can start to help us determine the content that we put out. So that's going to be very exciting. In the future months, we're going to be rolling out some more benefits from some of the higher tiers. But it's kind of like a support whenever you can. $3 a month, that seems like a nice foot in the door and yeah, a very easy sell. I don't even like... $3 is like half a cup of coffee now. So I don't even know what you say you can give up for $3 a month, what the equivalent is for $3 a month. But to whatever value we are to you and however much you want to help the future of the substance grow, have a couple of tiers there. Check it out in the show notes. Patreon is up. Very excited. Tell your friends. It'd be kind of weird if they didn't listen to the show, but if you have a really rich friend that just loves supporting independent artists, send them the $20 tier. That'd be cool.
Yeah. And if for whatever reason, monthly support isn't a thing that you can do, the Cash App, it will still be open. So if you want to support just a one-time way, you can do that. That link will be in the show notes as well. And then sharing the Patreon with friends is a great way, but any word of mouth recommendation of the show goes a long way, and you can do that easily over social media. Make sure you're following at The Substance Pod in all the places that we are, which is mainly Instagram, but also Twitter and Facebook. This is Editor Dave.
And I'm Philip Marinello, and we will see you next time on The Substance. Side note, is Paste where you recently did your Walter Hill list?
Yeah, that was where I did. So most of my freelancing these days is for Paste. I usually do like one or two big things like a month over at Paste. I really like writing over there. That was where, as you just kindly mentioned, I did a huge feature, like 10,000 words, ranking every single one of Walter Hill's directed features from worst to best. It's definitely like probably the biggest thing in terms of like labor that I've ever done. And I was really proud of how it turned out. So if you want to check that out, that'll be tight.
I will put a link to that in the show notes. I've enjoyed that.
But I think one of the things that Schrader does so brilliantly throughout so much of his career is he takes these characters who could be perceived as like bad guys who on their surface, maybe you don't like them, you don't want to spend time with them, and yet you can still really empathize with them. And I think that he pushes through that kind of barrier to find a place of understanding where like the pain that this guy has is coming from. And yeah, in this one, you really feel that pain.
I'm sorry for the screw up. I couldn't help it. Dave, thank you for doing such a great job for us.